You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The nonpartisan primary election for the superintendent of public instruction, Wisconsin's top education post, it's less than 3 weeks away. Seven candidates are running in the primary ahead of the April 6th general election. We're meeting the candidates in the coming weeks. And next up, it's Steve Kroll, principal of Garland Elementary School in Milwaukee. What do you want to know about his priorities for public schools in our state? Join in 800-642-1234. Steve, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Happy to be here.
So explain, why do you want this job? Why do you want to be the next state superintendent?
Sure. So first of all, I was born and raised in Wisconsin. And when I finished high school, I joined the U.S. Air Force. And there I was an instructor and then a training manager, and I learned a lot there. And two things that were very important that I think that I brought back with me are that I love to teach and that I was very good and trained at creating and organizing systemic change. But when I moved back to Milwaukee, what happened was that I became a teacher. I was a middle school teacher and then an elementary teacher, and I was quickly promoted then to academic coach and assistant principal, and now I'm a principal, where we also have put in major systemic change, and we're winning. So I'm running for state superintendent because I see us at a crossroads. You know, I see that our children and our grandchildren are having less opportunities. And, you know, recently I just read that for the first time in American history, we have a generation who is not doing economically as well as their parents. And I partially believe that's because of our education system. You know, Wisconsin used to be known for our great education system. I mean, we were top, right up there at the top. And what happened was, in the past 30 years, we've had these reforms that have been put in place, and they really have not been successful. You know, if they were, we wouldn't have a teacher shortage in the thousands that we have right now. We wouldn't have the largest opportunity gap in the nation. And we wouldn't have gotten rid of all of our vocational education programs and the broadband and transportation issues of our rural areas. So what the top-down approach just hasn't worked. And so I believe we need change.
And I want to just jump in here because of time, but COVID looms large as the pandemic continues. When do you think schools should be holding instruction virtually or in person? What is your plan for the pandemic?
So we're almost out of the woods on this one, but I think that what we need to do is look at our system, because I think that COVID really has spotlighted some of the major structural issues in our education system. I mean, the fact that we have some kids who are in classrooms of 15 while others are in classrooms of 45, well, that just prevents the type of safety measures that could be put in place during a pandemic, this one or a future one. You know, so this is an opportunity for us not only to rebuild our education system in a way that will ensure opportunity for our children and grandchildren, but I think it's also a planning mechanism for when a pandemic inevitably arrives again, right? I mean, so we need proper ventilation and HVAC systems in our schools. We need small class sizes. We need the PPE we need to be successful.
We're talking with Steve Kroll, who is principal of Milwaukee's Garland Elementary School. We're talking with one of seven candidates here running for state superintendent. Let's bring in John now in Appleton. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning, Kate, and thank you for your show and all you do. I wanted to ask Mr. Kroll, and I appreciate your situation of where you work. A couple of Milwaukee schools a few years ago started a year-round calendar, you know, where they're in 6 weeks and out for two. I'm wondering how innovative you want to be going forward with state schools for, you know, getting out of the 18th century model, calendar model, and going into a more up-to-date and more human-friendly calendar where, you know, education has definite peak times, but also some built-in remedial enrichment coping time for kids and all the families impacted by schools.
John, thanks so much, John. Let's have Steve jump in here.
Sure. So to the first part of the question, you know, year-round schools are a decent idea, but one of the major issues is, again, our infrastructure, where we don't have air conditioning. You know, kids have to feel physically, socially, and emotionally safe to learn. And if they're sweating because they can't focus, and then they can't focus on what they're learning, you know, that's not an effective way. But I do agree. What we do need to do is make sure that we shift from a rote type system to one where we can teach innovation and problem solving and critical thinking, because really that's what we need to make Wisconsin the innovators that we used to be.
How will children be able to be caught up here in the pandemic where we're losing so much ground? How do you suggest they catch up?
So something that needs to happen, in my view, is there needs to be structural reform as far as finances, because right now there's some districts that get roughly twice as much money per other districts for their base funding per student. And so we have these inputs that are vastly different, but we're expecting the same output. So really what we need to do is revamp our system. So that way, then, all children have the opportunities that they need and the supports that they need to be successful. I mean, we can spin our wheels all day long doing what we're currently doing, or we can make the meaningful change that I know that will not only be successful for, you know, students who already are in those environments, but all the students of Wisconsin across the state.
Okay, so when you look at the funding formula, then, which schools should receive more funding?
So first, I believe we need to establish a basic standard of student care. So essentially, we need to look at what are the basic things that when we go to any school within the state, it should have this, whether that's enrichment programs, a certain class size, quality and qualified teachers, whatever that is, we need to determine that and then fund it. Then additionally, we need to give students who need that additional help for special education or English learners or students who are in poverty, we need to give those additional supports through revenues that we tend to get from the federal government and from states as well.
How would you address our state's huge racial and economic disparities that divide student achievement, like straight across the state?
So part of that is the economic problem that I'm talking about. Really, you know, a lot of people talk about the achievement gap, which places the onus and the blame on teachers and students, but it's really an opportunity gap. That means that, like, we are not giving the same opportunities to all students in our state. And I'm not just talking about Milwaukee or urban areas. I'm saying rural areas, too. I mean, if you look at some of the funding differences that we see, I mean, it's just, honestly, I think, I don't want to put it this way, but I'm going to, our state values some kids more than other kids. And I think that's wrong.
Steve, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kate, and have a wonderful day.
You too. Steve Krull is principal of Garland Elementary School in Milwaukee. Coming up, we have another candidate vying to become the next state superintendent of public instruction. What questions do you have for Jill Underley? What do you want to know about her positions or her approach to COVID and schools? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We continue now our candidate conversations ahead of the nonpartisan primary election for the superintendent of public instruction. The primary is set for February 16th. Seven candidates are in the race ahead of the April 6th general election. And now we have Jill Underley, the superintendent of Pecatonica Area School District. It's about 20 miles southwest of Madison. What do you want to know about her priorities for public schools in our state? Join in 800-642-1234. Jill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, good morning. Thank you.
Yeah, why do you want to be Wisconsin's next superintendent?
All right, thanks. I'm running for Wisconsin State Superintendent because really I want to disrupt the inequities that plague our public school systems in Wisconsin. For me, it comes down to two things: optimism and equity. And I see so much good in our schools, but I also see so much inequity. And I'm running because we need a public school system that works for all kids, no matter where they live or who their parents are, And it's important to note that I'm the only candidate currently leading a school district during a pandemic. And I'm the mom of two middle school children attending school also during the pandemic. And I'm a true public school champion. And I see inequity every day in my district and districts throughout Wisconsin. And I want to disrupt those systems of inequity.
So when you talk about inequity, how would you specifically address our racial and economic disparities that are dividing student achievement around our state?
Sure. So, you know, I heard the previous candidate mention, you know, opportunity gaps. And, you know, that's based on, you know, a conversation that we've had with the Wisconsin Public Education Network and the work of John Diamond and Amanda Lewis. And the way to address that is to really look at what programs and systems we've had in place that really have not had any impact on, you know, the root causes of racism in our society. You have to look at, you know, well-funded schools, and you have to look at the opportunities that those schools provide to the kids that go to school there. So you think about early childhood programs and birth to three programs, getting kids the interventions that they need early, you know, so that sets them up for a lifetime of success. We have to acknowledge that we have a severe mental health shortage, you know, not just of practitioners, providers in our rural areas and our urban areas, and kids are struggling. So we need to support them, especially now as we weather the pandemic. And we also need to look at teachers. And we have a teacher shortage, and it's after a decade of, you know, austerity cuts, you know, to our public schools, but also the fact that people, you know, 10 years ago, we had some real struggles. And in our, you know, in the politics in Wisconsin, teachers left the profession. But now it's more important than ever that we get well-prepared teachers into our schools, because the kids who have inexperienced teachers or teachers that are not familiar with education and, you know, are just emergency licensed, those are the kids that are going to struggle. And we need to know that, and we have to agree that every child deserves these opportunities regardless of where they live, who they were born to, what language they speak at home, or what zip code they live in, rural or urban. And I'm really excited to get to work.
You mentioned that you're the candidate taking on a pandemic in a school system. When do you think schools should be holding instruction virtually? When should they be in the classroom?
Sure, that's a great question. And it's the million-dollar question, right? I wish we all had that answer. I think it's what's clear is that in order for kids to learn, they need to feel safe and they need to feel connected and they need to have positive relationships with adults in their schools and at home. And as long as we can keep our kids safe, whether it's through, you know, cleaning our buildings or, you know, with personal protective equipment, but we also have to keep our staff safe and healthy. And we can certainly be in person, but we need to keep everybody safe. And I just hope that the legislature would work closely with the DPI to provide the conditions through which safety can be met.
We're talking with one of the seven candidates running for state superintendent. Jill Underley is superintendent of the Pecatonica area school district, about 20 miles southwest of Madison. Let's bring in Alan now in Madison. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. I've been really encouraged by what you and the last candidate were saying about kind of changing school funding to be more equal. And so I just wanted to ask, I think a lot of the inequality in school funding comes from the sort of property tax-based funding model that means that people who live in nice areas with nice houses have nice schools, and people who might live in houses where they pay lower property taxes also have worse schools. And so this sort of perpetuates racial and economic inequality across generations. So what are some of your plans to sort of address that challenge that I think is at the heart of so much of the inequality that we're seeing?
Alan, thanks. Go ahead,
great
Jill.
Great question, Alan. You absolutely nailed it. I mean, that's really what it is. So right now we have equalized aid that comes from, you know, the state legislature through the Joint Finance Committee, and they determine how much money goes to the schools. And that pot of money, while it may look like it goes up every year, the pieces that it goes out to, or the, you know, the different entities it goes out to also increases. And I think our public taxpayers need to ask harder questions about school finance. So, for example, this past school year, the state allocated $385 million to private school vouchers. And that wasn't, that was an expense that didn't exist. You know, you think about it in like 1993. And so we have to look at some of these things that are, you know, impacting the amount of funding that goes to our schools. We also have to look at the costs that don't, you know, that exist now that didn't exist in 1993. I think about technology and how much technology has changed and now how much of a cost that is to our school districts. We really need to revise our funding formula so it is, you know, more favorable to public schools, and so schools can not only just keep their doors open without having to go to referendum, but that they can pay their staff, you know, a living wage and keep staff, you know, so staff could see a, you know, a future and a career in that school district, because our kids will benefit from that.
Let's bring in Jennifer now in Colby with a question. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi. As an educator, I'm just curious what your plan is for literacy. Our literacy scores, not just Wisconsin, but across the U.S., are falling and dismal. And with the pandemic, we're seeing, especially with early literacy skills, that's even lower. So what is your plan to increase our literacy skills? Because having those high literacy rates also give access to further education down the line.
I agree. Good question, Jennifer. So improving literacy, I believe, begins with early childhood education. You know, we need to provide interventions early because we need to set kids up for success. But, you know, in my experience as a school district administrator, and particularly somebody in a rural area, we need to work with our cooperative education service agencies, or the CESA. So CESA 9 up in your area, for example. And my plan would be to work with the CESAs when I'm at DPI to develop a cohesive curriculum framework, because that's what's missing. I mean, we have great standards, but it's the implementation of those standards that's left up to, you know, it's left up to individual school districts to decide how they teach them and how they roll them out. And so what we need to do is bring in the science of reading to the framework and then work with our CESAs to share that professional development with our teachers so that we can make sure that we're teaching the kids the best way that we can.
Jennifer, thanks. You know, looking at how our kids are doing in the pandemic, how do we catch them up? They are falling behind grade level really quickly. What would your approach be?
Yeah, you know, this is something I struggle with, too, because I see the one end, we want, you know, to be accountable, right? We got to stay on track, but that's really subjective, right? I mean, there are going to be kids that are going to be fine, you know, and we bring back that idea of the opportunity gap. The kids who are, you know, well-resourced at home and school, they're going to weather this just fine. It's the kids with, you know, like the students with disabilities, the EL learners, the kids in high poverty situations that don't have the support right now in the pandemic. And so for me, I am conflicted. I want kids to continue to learn, you know, certainly maybe after school programming, or we can do summer programming, but I also want them to just be okay, right? I want to advocate that they have mental health support. You know, I want to advocate that we can get, you know, broadband and high-speed wireless to, you know, all our communities, that it's affordable. You know, I want to advocate for all these enrichment experiences and remediation, but I also feel that people need to provide more grace to our public schools. I know people are frustrated, but I'm really just worried about the well-being of our kids first and foremost.
As we start to wrap up here, how could Wisconsin's public schools be better prepared for another pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, certainly something we did a couple of years ago at my school district was that we made sure that we were one-to-one with technology. You know, we made sure that we had the resources in place because we were looking at how to cut back on the number of snow days we had. But I think, you know, certainly making sure we have the technology, but we really need the infrastructure first. In Wisconsin, we need rural broadband or high-speed wireless access so that kids and families could work from home next time we do have a pandemic. The other side of it is we need to provide more training to our staff on how to make, you know, remote lessons more effective as well. But yeah, there's certainly a lot of other things I could probably go into, but it's really, how do you make things most normal in a pandemic? You know, it's really difficult.
Jill, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to be here. You know, just a simple thank you to all the parents, community members, and businesses who support their public schools, because I truly believe that our schools are the cornerstone of our democracy. So thanks for being engaged, and don't forget to vote on February 16th.
Jill Underlee is superintendent of Pecatonica Area School District in the southwestern part of the state. Ahead this hour, we talk with the Milwaukee County District Attorney to learn how authorities are responding to a rise in homicides. What questions do you have for Milwaukee's top county prosecutor about the violence in the city? It's 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about how to cook a particular dish in the Badger State.
A lot of official state foods. Cheese is the state dairy product, cranberries are the state fruit, and Kringle is the state pastry. But it doesn't have a state recipe for something like chili with macaroni in it, or does it? Andrea Anderson explains.
Joanna Nelson loves macaroni and chili. Her mom, Joyce Nelson, doesn't.
Okay, we've got the onions here.
They recently made Joyce's chili recipe for lunch at their Wausau home.
Mom, you let me know if I'm doing this right. I know you like to...
Oh, that's perfect.
She kind of showed me how to do this prior, so...
And out of love, Joyce even made some macaroni for her daughter.
Okay, these are about ready to go, and what I'm going to do, since I'm not putting them in the chili because I don't like them in the chili...
But you could, if you do like pasta in your chili, yes. You could add them right in.
Joanna says she's been a fan of macaroni and chili since she had it that way as a teenager.
It wasn't until later in life that I even realized there was this divide. You know, I was a little skeptical at first when I tried it. I think I was at a friend's house, but it was delicious. It just added so much.
But Joyce isn't budging.
When I make chili, it's just chili, no noodles. I think of them as an intruder.
Joanna was so intrigued by the way people eat their chili in Wisconsin that she asked WPR's Wisconsin, is there a right way?
Wisconsin-style chili is a mild chili that has the hamburger, and I use pork. It has usually elbow macaroni, red kidney beans only, as far as I know, tomato juice it's made with, and tomato soup.
Lynn Huntley calls herself a Wisconsin grandma and someone who enjoys food and cooking. She started a food blog called Turnips to Tangerines in 2012 that highlights traditional Wisconsin recipes. Huntley has a collection of more than 300 cookbooks, mostly from Wisconsin churches and service clubs. She says the same basic Wisconsin-style chili recipe is in many of those cookbooks. Huntley says chili is warm and perfect for winter. She and her husband eat a new batch monthly between November and March.
Yeah, it's filling and it makes a big batch so you can feed your family or a crowd.
Chili may be the most versatile recipe there is. And people who promote farm-to-table efforts in Wisconsin are planning the third annual Wisconsin Chili Lunch in February on National Chili Day.
Chili is something that is pretty universal. It's a lot of vegetables and beans and sometimes meat that we cook for a long time, and it's got a lot of flavor. Because it's so flexible, it's a great way to highlight everything that we do in Wisconsin.
Vanessa Harold is farm-to-institution outreach specialist for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Integrated Agriculture Systems. The Wisconsin Chili Lunch has traditionally been aimed at institutions like schools, early child care centers, and hospitals. The last time the event was held, about 50,000 bowls of chili were served.
Traditionally, we would encourage people to do it on the same day, but because of the pandemic, we're welcoming people to participate anytime in February.
Harold says they'd like people to register online for the event to access a lot of Wisconsin chili recipes, with or without macaroni noodles.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story on Wisconsin-style chili, which was produced by WPR's John Davis. The story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now we look at what is behind the spike in violence in Milwaukee. Our largest city set a new homicide record last year, exceeding the number of killings set back in 1991. Last year, the city saw more shootings involving children and more road rage. What should be done? What does your neighborhood need? Your perspective now, 800-642-1234. John Chisholm is Milwaukee County District Attorney. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much. I hope everybody is safe and healthy.
John, what can you tell us about the types of killings Milwaukee experienced last year?
Yeah, this was tragically a fatal year for our community, and it really impacted across a broad index of what we would call social suffering, right? It's certainly just looking at the homicides alone. As you mentioned, they set a record, a very bad record. Our previous worst year had been 1991, and that was just right in the midst of the crack cocaine infusion and epidemic, where we saw dramatic spikes in homicides. But last year we finished with 190 just within the city. We had 216 countywide, which is elevated for the county as well. And just so for comparison purposes, for 2019, we had had 97, and in 2018, we had had 99. Now, that's never good, but that's a number that is relatively consistent when you average it out, if we're essentially doing everything that we can to try to contain those numbers. And then the other major concern was that we had almost 775 non-fatal shootings. The previous year was about 450, and the year before that was about 476. So again, you put this in the context of the suffering associated with the pandemic. We had overdose deaths that almost broached 500. And you mentioned it, the categories are really concerning. Elevated rates of violence associated with family violence and domestic violence, and just an absolutely unacceptable number of child deaths. All of these things combine to really demand that we put all the resources that we can possibly put together to focus on the community that's most impacted. And that's the other distinction I'll make, and that is that this disproportionately, whether it's the COVID impact or the violence impact or the addiction impact, the poverty impact, it disproportionately falls on the people of color in our community, the black population,
victims were 86% black,
That's
more
it.
Than 80% male, and almost half were in their upper teens and 20s. Why are young black men dying or nearly dying by violence?
Right. It's a combination. It's a complex mix of issues that are rooted in a lot of different factors, but certainly it's been compounded, I would argue, by a number of factors. But what we have found over time, there's a professor from NYU, a gentleman by the name of Patrick Sharkey, who's examined major urban centers for the last 10 years and examined the sort of the root causes of violence and what actually prevents violence. And what his conclusion is that the most effective method of containing the virus of violence, if you want to put it that way, is having neighborhoods that are socially cohesive, that are supported, that have resources to provide the really early interventions that are needed to take place before things spin out of control. And so what we've come to understand is that we as a community really have to adopt that perspective that we're seeing and trying to implement in the public health context is completely relevant to trying to address violent crime. In short, if you've been exposed to high rates of trauma and violence throughout your life, you're going to think differently. You're going to behave differently. And when you're heavily armed, and everybody in this country is now heavily armed, it's going to lead to circumstances that are not going to be resolved rationally and peacefully sometimes. And that's what I would attribute a lot of it to.
You know, Milwaukee police confiscated thousands of guns last year. What effect does that have? Or do more just appear in their place?
Yeah, it has almost no effect. Even before being elected in 2006, I had led our violent crime task forces approaching it from, quite frankly, a deterrence standpoint. We aggressively prosecuted firearm offenders and sent some of them federally, and that actually has a impact. But the reality is that the accessibility of firearms just can't be stemmed at this point in time. So the approaches that we have to take, again, are getting to the problem much earlier. Some signs of hope for that would be that there is a recognition that we have to approach it from more than just law enforcement interventions. There's a role for those, obviously. I still maintain very strong position on those who use firearms to commit crimes. But the ideal thing that we want to do is take advantage of people with the lived experience. So the development of the Office of Violence Prevention with the Director Reggie Moore, the development of the Office of African American Affairs that really focuses on helping us develop that capacity within the community itself to monitor and identify and intervene before things spill out of control. And that has to be resourced on a really large scale. The way it's being done right now is just not adequate. The analogy I would make is that we found that we were completely unprepared for a pandemic because we had neglected the infrastructure in our public health system. The same thing's true. If we want to contain violence, we have to invest in those community institutions, the people, the neighborhood, and the families that have been most impacted and are desperately seeking solutions to those problems. In the context, as we saw through the social justice movement of the summer, where they don't trust many aspects of the criminal justice system, and that creates an additional challenge for us as public safety officials.
We're talking with Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. We're looking at the spike in homicides in the city and what can be done this year to quell the violence. How has the increase in violence affected you? Are you more worried about your safety? Has the trauma touched your family? How do you want the criminal justice system to respond? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with DA John Chisholm here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. Milwaukee had 190 people killed in homicides last year, shattering the record set in 1991. Milwaukee is not alone. Big cities across the country saw a rise in violence, and Researchers at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, have a new report for the Council on Criminal Justice. It points to economic stresses of the pandemic and the social unrest after the police killing of George Floyd as a couple of factors in the alarming increase. Let's bring in Mark now, joining us from Minnesota. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Yes, I don't know if the chief there or attorney is aware of a program out of Chicago called Cure Violence. They were able to reduce. Are you?
I am. I am indeed. In fact, the Office of Violence Prevention under the director Reggie Moore brought the Cure Violence up to Milwaukee about 3-4 years ago, and helped inform the creation of a community-generated document called the Milwaukee Blueprint for Peace. It's a public health-guided framework for how we address it. And what I would argue is that we have to go all in on that blueprint. And that blueprint does not talk about increasing the number of courts, police, prosecutors, prisons. What it focuses on is creating that capacity that Cure Violence demonstrated in the model in Oakland is similar, where you actually create the resources and capacity to intervene in ways that the people who have that lived experience of trauma and experience, they actually trust the people that are intervening and will provide them with information that they often do not feel comfortable providing us, so that you can actually act on it and hopefully prevent, you know, things like retaliation and the spread of violence that occurs. And it also, I would argue that, you know, consistent with the report out of Missouri, right, the economic factors play a key role in it. If we could address housing security, food security, if we could get people early access for medical care, mental health interventions, addressing their addiction issues before there has to be a law enforcement intervention, that's the challenge. I get it. We have enormous work to do in the criminal justice system to restore our credibility. But at the same time, if the expectation is that we're going to be the first responders to every single social problem, that's going to create a dynamic that is unsustainable and unworkable as well. So I think that from my perspective, I desperately want those entities in the community that would have the capacity to do those interventions much better than we do as the criminal justice system to be properly resourced, reinforced, and supported and work collaboratively with us to solve community problems.
Mark, what do you see? Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
What I don't think the public recognizes, because they haven't heard of this most likely, is that the Cure Dr. Gary Slutkin, specialist in infectious disease, lives in Chicago, recognized that there were clusters of murders in communities,
yes,
like you were talking about. And he said, well, this looks like the same thing I would have with an epidemic, meaning the murders are related to each other.
Spot on. I call violence the other pandemic is what's been going on for a long time, but it's accelerated in 2020.
Yes.
Yeah, you're spot on.
Yes.
The research has shown that violence does, in fact, behave like a virus. It spreads.
Yes. And so he developed a team of black men and women. That's his team. All ex-convicts.
Many of them are. And they have... experience. Yeah.
Yeah, Mark, thanks for the call. You know, there are teams of people called violence interrupters. John, what do they do?
So they actually respond to the scene of trauma. They respond. They'll show up in hospitals. They'll show up on the street. And they connect with generally the family members of the people impacted. And that would be on both sides, right? Because the other thing that we've come to deeply understand is the distinction between a victim and an offender is a frozen moment in time. Many of our victims have committed offenses in the past, and many of our offenders have been victims in the past. And what we want to do is take that frozen moment in time and approach it in a different way. And it's just not a binary, arrest and move on. It's really figure out what happened, get to the root cause of why this occurred, and try to limit the impact of the trauma on the people most infected. In part, uh, in, in particular the kids. That's where the focus has to be. If we want to change things generationally, we have to focus on addressing the traumas that are experienced across a whole spectrum of issues in our community.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with John Chisholm, who is the Milwaukee County District Attorney. We're looking at the spike in violent crime in Milwaukee and what can be done. You can join in. Are you a police officer or perhaps a social worker? What underlying social problems do you think is causing the spike in violence? How has it affected your work? 800-642-1234. John, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported in 2019 that fewer than half of the 494 homicides in Milwaukee between 2014 and 2017 had resulted in a conviction. Why are so few killers brought to justice?
Yeah, it's not even a conviction. Unfortunately, it's even a resolution. In other words, a determination that you had enough information to actually arrest somebody. And this is a major concern because, again, the research shows us that accountability is important. It is really important. And the Milwaukee Police Department had one of the nationally highest rates of clearance in the country for many years. They often hovered in the 90 to high 80 percentiles. Those numbers have gone down over time, and it's a combination of a number of factors. The reality is that law enforcement is stretched thin to the point of breaking in many circumstances, and the numbers are simply overwhelming. They have to respond, you know, if you're responding to over 500 overdose deaths, if you're responding to over 800 non-fatal shootings, if you're responding to thousands of domestic violence calls, if you're responding to social unrest, all of these things take an enormous toll on the resources. And most importantly, if the community doesn't feel that relationship of trust that they can provide information in a safe way, it makes it really, really difficult to acquire the type of evidence that's needed in our system to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a real challenge.
We only have a few seconds left, but experts say there is no vaccine for violence. There is no magic here. But what can be done today and tomorrow in Milwaukee, in the next weeks, in 2021, to address this?
Pull together, take the same approach that we've adopted in addressing the pandemic, not perfectly, but we've taken enormous steps. And the biggest step we have taken is coming together across all sectors of the community, sharing information, focusing our resources, our limited resources, in the most impactful way, guided by that public health approach, and trying to change the way we are doing business with one goal in mind, and that is make this community safe, make it healthy, and create the conditions where families and people can thrive.
John, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
John Chisholm has been the Milwaukee County District Attorney since 2006. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.